Mitford applauded. The fathers and mothers present applauded. Shrieks and exclamations were heard from the gallery where the ladies were sitting. Handkerchiefs were waved. The president began ringing his bell with all his might. He was obviously irritated by the behaviour of the audience, but did not venture to clear the court as he had threatened. Even persons of high position, old men with stars on their breasts, sitting on specially reserved seats behind the judges, applauded the orator and waved their handkerchiefs. So that when the noise died down, the president confined himself to repeating his stern threat to clear the court, and Fetyukovich, excited and triumphant, continued his speech.
Gentlemen of the jury, remember that awful night, of which so much has been said today, when the son got over the fence and stood face to face with the enemy and persecutor who had begotten him. I insist most emphatically it was not for money he ran to his father's house. The charge of robbery is an absurdity, as I proved before, and it was not to murder him he broke into the house. Oh, no! If he had had that design, he would at least have taken the precaution of arming himself beforehand. The brass pestle he caught up instinctively without knowing why he did it. Granted that he deceived his father by tapping at the window, granted that he made his way in, I've already said that I do not for a moment believe that legend, but let it be so, let us suppose it for a moment. Gentlemen, I swear to you by all that's holy, if it had not been his father but an ordinary enemy, he would, after running through the rooms and satisfying himself that the woman was not there, have made off post-haste without doing any harm to his rival. He would have struck him, pushed him away, perhaps nothing more, for he had no thought and no time to spare for that. What he wanted to know was where she was. But his father, the mere sight of the father who had hated him from his childhood, had been his enemy, his persecutor, and now his unnatural rival was enough. A feeling of hatred came over him involuntarily, irresistibly, clouding his reason. It all surged up in one moment. It was an impulse of madness and insanity, but also an impulse of nature, irresistibly and unconsciously, like everything in nature, avenging the violation of its eternal laws. But the prisoner even then did not murder him. I maintain that. I cry that aloud. No, he only brandished the pestle in a burst of indignant disgust, not meaning to kill him, not knowing that he would kill him. Had he not had this fatal pestle in his hand, he would have only knocked his father down, perhaps, but he would not have killed him. As he ran away, he did not know whether he had killed the old man. Such a murder is not a murder. Such a murder is not a parricide. No, the murder of such a father cannot be called parricide. Such a murder can only be reckoned parricide by prejudice. But I appeal to you again and again from the depths of my soul. Did this murder actually take place? Gentlemen of the jury, if we convict and punish him, he will say to himself, these people have done nothing for my bringing up, for my education, nothing to improve my lot, nothing to make me better, nothing to make me a man. These people have not given me to eat and to drink, have not visited me in prison and nakedness. And here they have sent me to penal servitude. I am quits. I owe them nothing now and owe no one anything forever. They are wicked and I will be wicked. They are cruel and I will be cruel. That is what he will say, gentlemen of the jury. And I swear by finding him guilty you will only make it easier for him. You will ease his conscience. He will curse the blood he has shed and will not regret it. At the same time, you will destroy in him the possibility of becoming a new man, for he will remain in his wickedness and blindness all his life. But do you want to punish him fearfully, terribly, with the most awful punishment that could be imagined, and at the same time to save him and regenerate his soul? If so, overwhelm him with your mercy. You will see, you will hear how he will tremble and be horror-struck. How can I endure this mercy? How can I endure so much love? Am I worthy of it? That's what he will exclaim. Oh, I know that heart, that wild but grateful heart, gentlemen of the jury. It will bow before your mercy. It thirsts for a great and loving action. It will melt and mount upwards. There are souls which in their limitation blame the whole world, but subdue such a soul with mercies, show it love, and it will cure its past, for there are many good impulses in it.
Such a heart will expand and see that God is merciful and that men are good and just. He will be horror-stricken. He will be crushed by remorse and the vast obligation laid upon him henceforth. And he will not say then, I am quits, but will say, I am guilty in the sight of all men and am more unworthy than all. With tears of penitence and poignant, tender anguish, he will exclaim, Others are better than I. They wanted to save me, not to ruin me. Oh, this act of mercy is so easy for you, for in the absence of anything like real evidence, it will be too awful for you to pronounce, Yes, he is guilty.
Better acquit 10 guilty men than punish one innocent man. Do you hear? Do you hear that majestic voice from the past century of our glorious history? It is not for an insignificant person like me to remind you that the Russian court does not exist for the punishment only, but also for the salvation of the criminal. Let other nations think of retribution and the letter of the law. We will cling to the spirit and the meaning, the salvation and the reformation of the lost. If this is true, if Russia and her justice are such, she may go forward with good cheer. Do not try to scare us with your frenzied troikas, from which all the nations stand aside in disgust. Not a runaway troika, but the stately chariot of Russia will move calmly and majestically to its goal. In your hands is the fate of my client. In your hands is the fate of Russian justice. You will defend it. You will savor it. You will prove that there are men to watch over it, that it is in good hands.
Chapter 14. The Peasants Stand Firm. This was how Fetyukovich concluded his speech, and the enthusiasm of the audience burst like an irresistible storm. It was out of the question to stop it. The women wept. Many of the men wept, too. Even two important personages shed tears. The president submitted, and even postponed ringing his bell. The suppression of such an enthusiasm would be the suppression of something sacred, as the ladies cried afterwards. The orator himself was genuinely touched. And it was at this moment that Ippolit Kirillovich got up to make certain objections. People looked at him with hatred. What? What's the meaning of it? He positively dares to make objections? The ladies babbled. But if the whole world of ladies, including his wife, had protested, he could not have been stopped at that moment. He was pale. He was shaking with emotion. His first phrases were even unintelligible. He gasped for breath, could hardly speak clearly, lost the thread. But he soon recovered himself. Of this new speech of his, I will quote only a few sentences.
I am reproached with having woven a romance. But what is this defense if not one romance on the top of another? All that was lacking was poetry. Fyodor Pavlovich, while waiting for his mistress, tears open the envelope and throws it on the floor. We are even told what he said while engaged in this strange act. Is not this a flight of fancy? And what proof have we that he had taken out the money? Who heard what he said? The weak-minded idiot Smerdyakov, transformed into a Byronic hero, avenging society for his illegitimate birth. Isn't this a romance in the Byronic style? And the son who breaks into his father's house and murders him without murdering him is not even a romance. This is a sphinx setting us a riddle which he cannot solve himself. If he murdered him, he murdered him. And what's the meaning of his murdering him without having murdered him? Who can make head or tail of this? Then we are admonished that our tribune is a tribune of true and sound ideas, and from this tribune of sound ideas is heard a solemn declaration that to call the murder of a father parricide is nothing but a prejudice. But if parricide is a prejudice, and if every child is to ask his father why he's to love him, what will become of us? What will become of the foundations of society? What will become of the family? Parricide, it appears, is only a bogey of Moscow merchants' wives. The most precious and most sacred guarantees for the destiny and future of Russian justice are presented to us in a perverted and frivolous form, simply to attain an object, to obtain the justification of something which cannot be justified. Oh, crush him by mercy, cries the counsel for the defense. But that's all the criminal wants, and tomorrow it will be seen how much he is crushed. And is not the counsel for the defense too modest in asking only for the acquittal of the prisoner? Why not found a charity in the honor of the parricide to commemorate his exploit among future generations? Religion and the gospel are corrected. That's all mysticism, we're told, and ours is the only true Christianity which has been subjected to the analysis of reason and common sense. And so they set up before us a false semblance of Christ. What measure ye mete, so it shall be meted unto you again, cries the counsel for the defence, and instantly deduces that Christ teaches us to measure as it is measured to us, and this from the tribune of truth and sound sense. We peep into the gospel only on the eve of making speeches, in order to dazzle the audience by our acquaintance with what is, anyway, a rather original composition, which may be of use to produce a certain effect, all to serve the purpose. But what Christ commands us is something very different. He bids us beware of doing this, because the wicked world does this, but we ought to forgive and to turn the other cheek, and not to measure to our persecutors as they measure to us. This is what our God has taught us, and not that to forbid children to murder their fathers is a prejudice. And we will not, from the tribune of truth and good sense, correct the gospel of our Lord, whom the counsel for the defence deigns to call only the crucified lover of humanity, in opposition to all orthodox Russia, which calls to him, "For thou art our God." At this the President intervened, and checked the overzealous speaker, begging him not to exaggerate, not to overstep the bounds, and so on, as Presidents always do in such cases. The audience, too, was uneasy. The public was restless. There were even exclamations of indignation. Fetyukovich did not so much as reply. He only mounted the tribune to lay his hand on his heart, and with an offended voice utter a few words full of dignity. He only touched again, lightly and ironically, on romancing and psychology, and in an appropriate place quoted, "Jupiter, you are angry, therefore you are wrong," which provoked a burst of approving laughter in the audience, for Ippolit Kirillovich was by no means like Jupiter. Then, apropos of the accusation that he was teaching the young generation to murder their fathers, Fetyukovich observed with great dignity that he would not even answer. As for the prosecutor's charge of uttering unorthodox opinions, Fetyukovich hinted that it was a personal insinuation, and that he had expected in this court to be secure from accusations damaging to my reputation as a citizen and a loyal subject. But at these words the President pulled him up too, and Fetyukovich concluded his speech with a bow amid a hum of approbation in the court. And Ippolit Kirillovich was, in the opinion of our ladies, crushed for good. Then the prisoner was allowed to speak. Mitya stood up, but said very little. He was fearfully exhausted, physically and mentally. The look of strength and independence with which he had entered in the morning had almost disappeared. He seemed as though he'd passed through an experience that day which had taught him for the rest of his life something very important he had not understood till then. His voice was weak. He did not shout as before. In his words there was a new note of humility, defeat, and submission. "What am I to say, gentlemen of the jury? The hour of judgment has come for me. I feel the hand of God upon me. The end has come to an erring man, but before God I repeat to you I am innocent of my father's blood. For the last time I repeat it wasn't I killed him. I was erring, but I loved what is good. Every instant I strove to reform, but I lived like a wild beast. I thank the prosecutor, he told me many things about myself that I did not know. But it's not true that I killed my father. The prosecutor is mistaken. I thank my counsel, too. I cried listening to him. But it's not true that I killed my father, and he needn't have supposed it. And don't believe the doctors. I'm perfectly sane. Only my heart is heavy. If you spare me, if you let me go, I will pray for you. I will be a better man. I give you my word before God, I will. And if you will condemn me, I'll break my sword over my head myself and kiss the pieces. But spare me, do not rob me of my God. I know myself, I shall rebel. My heart is heavy, gentlemen. Spare me." He almost fell back in his place. His voice broke. He could hardly articulate the last phrase. Then the judges proceeded to put the questions and began to ask both sides to formulate their conclusions. But I will not describe the details.
At last the jury rose to retire for consultation. The president was very tired, and so his last charge to the jury was rather feeble.
"Be impartial. Don't be influenced by the eloquence of the defense, but yet weigh the arguments. Remember that there is a great responsibility laid upon you."
And so on and so on. The jury withdrew and the court adjourned. People could get up, move about, exchange their accumulated impressions, refresh themselves at the buffet. It was very late, almost 1 o'clock in the night. But nobody went away. The strain was so great that no one could think of repose. All waited with sinking hearts. Though that is perhaps too much to say, for the ladies were only in a state of hysterical impatience, and their hearts were untroubled. An acquittal, they thought, was inevitable. They all prepared themselves for a dramatic moment of general enthusiasm. I must own there were many among the men, too, who were convinced that an acquittal was inevitable. Some were pleased, others frowned, while some were simply dejected, not wanting him to be acquitted. Fetyukovich himself was confident of his success. He was surrounded by people congratulating him and fawning upon him. "There are," he said to one group, as I was told afterwards, "there are invisible threads that bind the counsel for the defense with the jury. One feels during one's speech if they are being formed. I was aware of them. They exist. Our cause is won. Set your mind at rest."
"What will our peasants say now?"
said one stout, cross-looking, pock-marked gentleman, a landowner of the neighborhood, approaching a group of gentlemen engaged in conversation.
"But they're not all peasants. There are four government clerks among them."
"Yes, there are clerks," said a member of the district council, joining the group.
"And do you know that Nazariev, the merchant with the medal, a juryman?"
"What of him?"
"He's a man with brains, but he never speaks. He's no great talker, but so much the better. There's no need for the Petersburg man to teach him. He could teach all Petersburg himself. He's the father of 12 children, think of that."
"Upon my word, you don't suppose they won't acquit him?"
one of our young officials exclaimed in another group.
"They'll acquit him for certain," said a resolute voice.
"It would be shameful, disgraceful, not to acquit him," cried the official. "Suppose he did murder him. There are fathers and fathers, and besides, he was in such a frenzy. He really may have done nothing but swing the pestle in the air and so knock the old man down, but it was a pity they dragged the valet in. That was simply an absurd theory. If I'd been in Fetyukovich's place, I should simply have said straight out, 'He murdered him, but he's not guilty. Hang it all.'"
"That's what he did, only without saying 'hang it all.'"
"No, Mikhail Semyonovich, he almost said that too," put in a third voice.
"Why, gentlemen, in Lent an actress was acquitted in our town who had cut the throat of her lover's lawful wife."
"Oh, but she did not finish cutting it."
"Well, that makes no difference. She began cutting it."
"What did you think of what he said about children? Splendid, wasn't it?"
"Splendid."
"And about mysticism, too."
"Oh, drop mysticism, do," cried someone else. "Think of Hippolyte and his fate from this day forth. His wife'll scratch his eyes out tomorrow for Mitya's sake."
"Is she here?"
"What an idea. If she'd been here, she'd have scratched them out in court. She's at home with toothache."
"Hee hee hee."
In a third group.
"I dare say they will acquit Mitenka after all."
"I should not be surprised if he turns the metropolis upside down tomorrow. He'll be drinking for 10 days.
"Oh, the devil."
"Well, the devil's bound to have a hand in it. Where should he be, if not here?"
"Well, gentlemen, I admit it was eloquent, but still it's not the thing to break your father's head with a pestle. Or what are we coming to?"
"The chariot. Do you remember the chariot?"
"Yes, he turned a cart into a chariot."
"And tomorrow he'll turn a chariot into a cart, just to suit his purpose."
"What cunning chaps there are nowadays. Is there any justice to be had in Russia?"
But the bell rang. The jury deliberated for exactly an hour, neither more nor less. A profound silence reigned in the court as soon as the public had taken their seats. I remember how the jurymen walked into the court. At last. I won't repeat the questions in order, and indeed I've forgotten them. I remember only the answer to the president's first and chief question.
"Did the prisoner commit the murder for the sake of robbery and with premeditation?"
I don't remember the exact words. There was a complete hush. The foreman of the jury, the youngest of the clerks, pronounced,
in a clear, loud voice, amidst the death-like stillness of the court. "Yes, guilty." And the same answer was repeated to every question. "Yes, guilty." And without the slightest extenuating comment. This no one had expected. Almost everyone had reckoned upon a recommendation to mercy, at least. The death-like silence in the court was not broken. All seemed petrified. Those who desired his conviction as well as those who had been eager for his acquittal. But that was only for the first instant, and it was followed by a fearful hubbub. Many of the men in the audience were pleased. Some were rubbing their hands with no attempt to conceal their joy. Those who disagreed with the verdict seemed crushed, shrugged their shoulders, whispered, but still seemed unable to realize this. But how shall I describe the state the ladies were in? I thought they would create a riot. At first they could scarcely believe their ears. Then suddenly the whole court rang with exclamations. "What's the meaning of it? What next?" They leapt up from their places. They seemed to fancy that it might be at once reconsidered and reversed. At that instant, Mitya suddenly stood up and cried in a heart-rending voice, stretching his hands out before him. "I swear by God and the dreadful day of judgment I am not guilty of my father's blood. Katya, I forgive you. Brothers, friends, have pity on the other woman." He could not go on and broke into a terrible sobbing wail that was heard all over the court, in a strange, unnatural voice unlike his own. From the furthest corner at the back of the gallery came a piercing shriek. It was Grushenka. She had succeeded in begging admittance to the court, again, before the beginning of the lawyer's speeches. Mitya was taken away. The passing of the sentence was deferred till next day. The whole court was in a hubbub, but I did not wait to hear. I only remember a few exclamations I heard on the steps as I went out. "He'll have a 20 years trip to the mines." "Not less." "Well, our peasants have stood firm." "And have done for our Mitya." Epilogue. Chapter 1. Plans for Mitya's escape. Very early at 9 o'clock in the morning, 5 days after the trial, Alyosha went to Katerina Ivanovna's to talk over a matter of great importance to both of them, and to give her a message. She sat and talked to him in the very room in which she had once received Grushenka. In the next room, Ivan Fyodorovitch lay unconscious in a high fever. Katerina Ivanovna had immediately after the scene at the trial ordered the sick and unconscious man to be carried to her house, disregarding the inevitable gossip and general disapproval of the public. One of the two relations who lived with her had departed to Moscow immediately after the scene at the court. The other remained. But if both had gone away, Katerina Ivanovna would have adhered to her resolution and would have gone on nursing the sick man and sitting by him day and night. Varvinsky and Herzenstube were attending him. The famous doctor had gone back to Moscow, refusing to give an opinion as to the probable end of the illness. Though the doctors encouraged Katerina Ivanovna and Alyosha, it was evident that they could not yet give them positive hopes of recovery. Alyosha came to see his sick brother twice a day. But this time he had specially urgent business, and he foresaw how difficult it would be to approach the subject. Yet he was in great haste. He had another engagement that could not be put off for that same morning, and there was need of haste. They had been talking for a quarter of an hour. Katerina Ivanovna was pale and terribly fatigued, yet at the same time in a state of hysterical excitement. She had a presentiment of the reason why Alyosha had come to her. "Don't worry about his decision," she said with confident emphasis to Alyosha. "One way or another, he's bound to come to it. He must escape. That unhappy man, that hero of honor and principle. Not he, not Dmitri Fyodorovitch, but the man lying the other side of that door, who has sacrificed himself for his brother." Katya added with flashing eyes, "told me the whole plan of escape long ago. You know he's already entered into negotiations. I've told you something already. You see, it will probably come off at the third etape from here, when the party of prisoners is being taken to Siberia. Oh, it's a long way off yet. Ivan Fyodorovich has already visited the superintendent of the third etape. But we don't know yet who will be in charge of the party, and it's impossible to find that out so long beforehand. Tomorrow perhaps I'll show you in detail the whole plan, which Ivan Fyodorovich left me on the eve of the trial in case of need. That was when, do you remember, you found us quarrelling? He'd just gone downstairs. But seeing you, I made him come back. Do you remember? Do you know what we were quarrelling about then?
No, I don't, said Alyosha.
Of course he did not tell you it was about that plan of escape. He had told me the main idea 3 days before, and we began quarrelling about it at once and quarrelled for 3 days. We quarrelled because when he told me that if Dmitri Fyodorovich were convicted he would escape abroad with that creature, I felt furious at once. I can't tell you why. I don't know myself why. Oh, of course, I was furious then about that creature and that she too should go abroad with Dmitri.
Katerina Ivanovna exclaimed suddenly, her lips quivering with anger.
As soon as Ivan Fyodorovich saw that I was furious about that woman, he instantly imagined I was jealous of Dmitri and that I still loved Dmitri. That is how our first quarrel began. I would not give an explanation. I could not ask forgiveness. I could not bear to think that such a man could suspect me of still loving that. And when I myself had told him long before that I did not love Dmitri, that I loved no one but him, it was only resentment against that creature that made me angry with him. 3 days later, on the evening you came, he brought me a sealed envelope, which I was to open at once if anything happened to him. Oh, he foresaw his illness. He told me that the envelope contained the details of the escape and that if he died or was taken dangerously, I was to save Mitya alone. Then he left me money, nearly 10,000, those notes to which the prosecutor referred in his speech, having learnt from someone that he'd sent them to be changed. I was tremendously impressed to find that Ivan Fyodorovich had not given up his idea of saving his brother, and was confiding this plan of escape to me, though he was still jealous of me and still convinced that I loved Mitya. Oh, that was a sacrifice. No, you cannot understand the greatness of such self-sacrifice, Alexei Fyodorovich. I wanted to fall at his feet in reverence, but I thought at once that he would take it only for my joy at the thought of Mitya's being saved. And he certainly would have imagined that. And I was so exasperated at the mere possibility of such an unjust thought on his part that I lost my temper again, and instead of kissing his feet, flew into a fury again. Oh, I am unhappy. It's my character, my awful unhappy character. Oh, you will see, I shall end by driving him too to abandon me for another, with whom he can get on better, like Dmitri. But no, I could not bear it. I should kill myself. And when you came in then, and when I called you and told him to come back, I was so enraged by the look of contempt and hatred he turned on me that, do you remember, I cried out to you that it was he alone, who had persuaded me that his brother Dmitri was a murderer. I said that malicious thing on purpose, to wound him again. He had never, never persuaded me that his brother was a murderer. On the contrary, it was I who persuaded him. Oh, my vile temper was the cause of everything. I paved the way to that hideous scene at the trial. He wanted to show me that he was an honourable man, and that even if I loved his brother, he would not ruin him for revenge or jealousy. So he came to the court. I am the cause of it all. I alone am to blame.
Katya never had made such confessions to Alyosha before, and he felt that she was now at that stage of unbearable suffering when even the proudest heart painfully crushes its pride and falls vanquished by grief. Oh, Alyosha knew another terrible reason of her present misery, though she had carefully concealed it from him during those days since the trial. It would have been for some reason too painful to him if she'd been brought so low as to speak to him now about that. She was suffering for her treachery at the trial, and Alyosha felt that her conscience was impelling her to confess it to him. To him, Alyosha, with tears and cries and hysterical writhings on the floor. But he dreaded that moment and longed to spare her. It made the commission on which he'd come even more difficult. He spoke of Mitya again.
It's all right, don't be anxious about him. she began again, sharply and stubbornly. "All that is only momentary. I know him. I know his heart only too well. You may be sure he will consent to escape. It's not as though it would be immediately. He'll have time to make up his mind to it. Ivan Fyodorovitch will be well by that time, and will manage it all himself, so that I shall have nothing to do with it. Don't be anxious. He will consent to run away. He's agreed already. You suppose he'd give up that creature? And they won't let her go to him, so he's bound to escape. It's you he's most afraid of. He's afraid you won't approve of his escape on moral grounds. But you must generously allow it, if your sanction is so necessary." Katya added viciously. She paused and smiled. "He talks about some hymn," she went on again. "Some cross he has to bear, some duty. I remember Ivan Fyodorovitch told me a great deal about it. And if you knew how he talked—" Katya cried suddenly, with feeling she could not repress. "If you knew how he loved that wretched man at the moment he told me, and how he hated him, perhaps, at the same moment. And I heard his story and his tears with sneering disdain. Brute. Yes, I'm a brute. I am responsible for his fever. But that man in prison is incapable of suffering," Katya concluded irritably. "Can such a man suffer? Men like him never suffer." There was a note of hatred and contemptuous repulsion in her words, and yet it was she who had betrayed him. Perhaps because she feels how she's wronged him, she hates him at moments, Alyosha thought to himself. He hoped that it was only at moments. In Katya's last words, he detected a challenging note, but he did not take it up. "I sent for you this morning to make you promise to persuade him yourself. Or do you too consider that to escape would be dishonorable, cowardly, or something unchristian, perhaps?" Katya added even more defiantly. "Oh no, I'll tell him everything," muttered Alyosha. "He asks you to come and see him today," he blurted out suddenly, looking her steadily in the face. She started and drew back a little from him on the sofa. "Me? Can that be?" she faltered, turning pale. "It can and ought to be," Alyosha began emphatically, growing more animated. "He needs you particularly just now. I would not have opened the subject and worried you if it were not necessary. He is ill. He's beside himself. He keeps asking for you. It is not to be reconciled with you that he wants you, but only that you would go and show yourself at his door. So much has happened to him since that day. He realizes that he has injured you beyond all reckoning. He does not ask your forgiveness. It's impossible to forgive me, he says himself, but only that you would show yourself in his doorway." It's so sudden," faltered Katya. "I had a presentiment all these days that you would come with that message. I knew he would ask me to come. It's impossible." "Let it be impossible, but do it. Only think, he realizes for the first time how he's wounded you. The first time in his life. He'd never grasped it before so fully. He said, 'If she refuses to come, I shall be unhappy all my life.' Do you hear? Though he's condemned to penal servitude for 20 years, he's still planning to be happy. Is not that piteous? Think. You must visit him. Though he is ruined, he is innocent." Broke like a challenge from Alyosha. "His hands are clean. There's no blood on them. For the sake of his infinite sufferings in the future, visit him now. Go greet him on his way into the darkness. Stand at his door, that is all. You ought to do it. You ought to." Alyosha concluded, laying immense stress on the word ought. "I ought to, but I cannot," Katya moaned. "He will look at me. I cannot." "Your eyes ought to meet. How will you live all your life if you don't make up your mind to do it now?" "Better suffer all my life." "You ought to go. You ought to go," Alyosha repeated with merciless emphasis. "But why today? Why at once? I can't leave our patient. You can for a moment. It will only be a moment. If you don't come, he will be in delirium by tonight. I would not tell you a lie. Have pity on him.
Have pity on me.
Katya said with bitter reproach, and she burst into tears. Then you will come, said Alyosha firmly, seeing her tears. I'll go and tell him you'll come directly.
No, don't tell him so on any account,
cried Katya in alarm. I will come, but don't tell him beforehand. For perhaps I may go, but not go in. I don't know yet. Her voice failed her. She gasped for breath. Alyosha got up to go.
And what if I meet anyone?
She said suddenly in a low voice, turning white again. That's just why you must go now, to avoid meeting anyone. There will be no one there, I can tell you that for certain. We will expect you, he concluded emphatically, and went out of the room. Chapter 2. For a moment, the lie becomes truth. He hurried to the hospital where Mitya was lying now. The day after his fate was determined, Mitya had fallen ill with nervous fever and was sent to the prison division of the town hospital. But at the request of several persons, Alyosha, Madame Holakov, Lisa, etc., Dr. Varvinsky had put Mitya not with other prisoners, but in a separate little room, the one where Smerdyakov had been. It is true that there was a sentinel at the other end of the corridor, and there was a grating over the window, so that Varvinsky could be at ease about the indulgence he had shown, which was not quite legal indeed, but he was a kind-hearted and compassionate young man. He knew how hard it would be for a man like Mitya to pass at once so suddenly into the society of robbers and murderers, and that he must get used to it by degrees. The visits of relations and friends were informally sanctioned by the doctor and overseer, and even by the police captain. But only Alyosha and Grushenka had visited Mitya. Rakitin had tried to force his way in twice, but Mitya persistently begged Varvinsky not to admit him. Alyosha found him sitting on his bed in a hospital dressing gown, rather feverish, with a towel soaked in vinegar and water on his head. He looked at Alyosha as he came in, with an undefined expression, but there was a shade of something like dread discernible in it. He'd become terribly preoccupied since the trial. Sometimes he would be silent for half an hour together, and seemed to be pondering something heavily and painfully, oblivious of everything about him. If he roused himself from his brooding and began to talk, he always spoke with a kind of abruptness, and never of what he really wanted to say. He looked sometimes with a face of suffering at his brother. He seemed to be more at ease with Grushenka than with Alyosha. It is true he scarcely spoke to her at all, but as soon as she came in his whole face lighted up with joy. Alyosha sat down beside him on the bed in silence. This time Mitya was waiting for Alyosha in suspense, but he did not dare ask him a question. He felt it almost unthinkable that Katya would consent to come, and at the same time he felt that if she did not come, something inconceivable would happen. Alyosha understood his feelings.
"Trifon Borisovitch," Mitya began nervously, "has pulled his hole into pieces, I'm told. He's taken up the flooring, pulled apart the planks, split up all the gallery, I'm told. He's seeking treasure all the time, the 1,500 rubles which the prosecutor said I'd hidden there. He began playing these tricks, they say, as soon as he got home. Serve him right, the swindler. The guard here told me yesterday he comes from there."
"Listen," began Alyosha, "she will come, but I don't know when. Perhaps today, perhaps in a few days, that I can't tell. But she will come, she will, that's certain." Mitya started, would have said something, but was silent. The news had a tremendous effect on him. It was evident that he would have liked terribly to know what had been said, but he was again afraid to ask. Something cruel and contemptuous from Katya would have cut him like a knife at that moment. "This was what she said, among other things, that I must be sure to set your conscience at rest about escaping. If Ivan is not well by then, she will see to it all herself."
"You've spoken of that already," Mitya observed musingly.
"And you have repeated it to Grusha," observed Alyosha.
"Yes," Mitya admitted. "She won't come this morning."
He looked timidly at his brother.
"She won't come till the evening. When I told her yesterday that Katya was taking measures, she was silent. But she set her mouth, she only whispered.
let her. She understood that it was important. I did not dare to try her further. She understands now, I think, that Katya no longer cares for me, but loves Ivan.
Does she?
Broke from Alyosha. Perhaps she does not, only she is not coming this morning.
Mitya hastened to explain again.
I asked her to do something for me. You know, Ivan is superior to all of us. He ought to live. Not us. He will recover.
Would you believe it? Though Katya is alarmed about him, she scarcely doubts of his recovery, said Alyosha.
That means that she is convinced he will die. It's because she's frightened. She's so sure he will get well.
Ivan has a strong constitution, and I, too, believe there's every hope that he will get well. Alyosha observed anxiously.
Yes, he will get well, but she is convinced that he will die. She has a great deal of sorrow to bear.
A silence followed. A grave anxiety was fretting Mitya.
Alyosha, I love Grusha terribly,
he said suddenly in a shaking voice full of tears.
They won't let her go out there to you,
Alyosha put in at once.
And there is something else I wanted to tell you,
Mitya went on with a sudden ring in his voice.
If they beat me on the way out there, I won't submit to it. I shall kill someone and shall be shot for it. And this will be going on for 20 years. They speak to me rudely as it is. I've been lying here all night passing judgment on myself. I'm not ready. I'm not able to resign myself. I wanted to sing a hymn, but if a guard speaks to me, I have not the strength to bear it. For Grusha, I would bear anything, anything except blows. But she won't be allowed to come there.
Alyosha smiled gently. Listen, brother, once for all, he said. This is what I think about it, and you know that I would not tell you a lie. Listen, you are not ready, and such a cross is not for you. What's more, you don't need such a martyr's cross when you're not ready for it. If you had murdered our father, it would grieve me that you should reject your punishment, but you are innocent, and such a cross is too much for you. You wanted to make yourself another man by suffering. I say, only remember that other man always, all your life, from wherever you go, and that will be enough for you. Your refusal of that great cross will only serve to make you feel all your life an even greater duty, and that constant feeling will do more to make you a new man, perhaps, than if you went there. For there you would not endure it and would repine, and perhaps at last would say, I'm quits. The lawyer was right about that. Such heavy burdens are not for all men. For some, they're impossible. These are my thoughts about it, if you want them so much. If other men would have to answer for your escape, officers or soldiers, then I would not have allowed you, smiled Alyosha. But they declare, the superintendent of that etape told Ivan himself, that if it's well managed, there will be no great inquiry, and that they can get off easily. Of course, bribing is dishonest, even in such a case, but I can't undertake to judge about it, because if Ivan and Katya commissioned me to act for you, I know I should go and give bribes. I must tell you the truth. And so I can't judge of your own action. But let me assure you that I shall never condemn you. And it would be a strange thing if I could judge you in this. Now, I think I've gone into everything.
But I do condemn myself, cried Mitya. I shall escape. That was settled apart from you. Could Mitya Karamazov do anything but run away? But I shall condemn myself, and I will pray for my sin forever. That's how the Jesuits talk, isn't it? Just as we are doing?
Yes. Alyosha smiled gently.
I love you for always telling the whole truth and never hiding anything,
cried Mitya with a joyful laugh.
So I've caught my Alyosha being Jesuitical. I must kiss you for that. Now, listen to the rest. I'll open the other side of my heart to you. This is what I planned and decided. If I run away, even with money and a passport and even to America, I should be cheered up by the thought that I'm not running away for pleasure, not for happiness, but to another exile as bad, perhaps, as Siberia. It is as bad, Alyosha. It is. I hate that America, damn it, already. Even though Grusha will be with me. Just look at her. Is she an American? She's Russian, Russian to the marrow of her bones. She will be homesick for the mother country, and I shall see every hour that she is suffering for my sake, that she's taken up that cross for me. And what harm has she done? And how shall I, too, put up with the rabble out there, though they may be better than I, every one of them? I hate that America already. And though they may be wonderful as machinery, every one of them, damn them, they're not of my soul. I love Russia, Alyosha, I love the Russian God, though I am a scoundrel myself. I shall choke there!"
he exclaimed, his eyes suddenly flashing. His voice was trembling with tears.
"So this is what I've decided, Alyosha, listen,"
he began again, mastering his emotion.
"As soon as I arrive there with Grusha, we will set to work at once on the land, in solitude, somewhere very remote, with wild bears. There must be some remote parts even there. I'm told there are still redskins there somewhere on the edge of the horizon. So to the country of the last of the Mohicans, and there we'll tackle the grammar at once, Grusha and I. Work and grammar, that's how we spend 3 years. And by that time we shall speak English like any Englishman. And as soon as we've learnt it, goodbye to America. We'll run here to Russia as American citizens. Don't be uneasy, we would not come to this little town. We'd hide somewhere a long way off, in the north or in the south. I shall be changed by that time, and she will, too, in America. The doctors shall make me some sort of wart on my face. What's the use of their being so mechanical? Or else I'll put out one eye, let my beard grow a yard, and I shall turn grey, fretting for Russia. I dare say they won't recognize us. And if they do, let them send us to Siberia. I don't care. It will show it's our fate. We'll work on the land here, too, somewhere in the wilds, and I'll make up as an American all my life. But we shall die on our own soil. That's my plan, and it shan't be altered. Do you approve?"
"Yes," said Alyosha, not wanting to contradict him. Mitya paused for a minute and said suddenly,
"And how they worked it up at the trial, didn't they work it up?"
"If they had not, you would have been convicted just the same," said Alyosha with a sigh.
"Yes, people are sick of me here, God bless them, but it's hard."
Mitya moaned miserably. Again there was silence for a minute.
"Alyosha, put me out of my misery at once," he exclaimed suddenly. "Tell me, is she coming now or not? Tell me. What did she say? How did she say it?"
"She said she would come, but I don't know whether she will come today. It's hard for her, you know." Alyosha looked timidly at his brother.
"I should think it is hard for her. Alyosha, it will drive me out of my mind. Grusha keeps looking at me, she understands. My God, calm my heart. What is it I want? I want Katya. Do I understand what I want? It's the headstrong, evil Karamazov spirit. No, I'm not fit for suffering. I'm a scoundrel, that's all one can say."
"Here she is," cried Alyosha. At that instant Katya appeared in the doorway. For a moment she stood still, gazing at Mitya with a dazed expression. He leapt impulsively to his feet, and a scared look came into his face. He turned pale, but a timid, pleading smile appeared on his lips at once, and with an irresistible impulse he held out both hands to Katya. Seeing it, she flew impetuously to him. She seized him by the hands, and almost by force made him sit down on the bed. She sat down beside him, and still keeping his hands, pressed them violently. Several times they both strove to speak, but stopped short, and again gazed speechless with a strange smile, their eyes fastened on one another. So passed 2 minutes.
"Have you forgiven me?"
Mitya faltered at last, and at the same moment, turning to Alyosha, his face working with joy, he cried,
"Do you hear what I'm asking? Do you hear?"
"That's what I loved you for, that you are generous at heart," broke from Katya. "My forgiveness is no good to you, nor yours to me. Whether you forgive me or not, you will always be a sore place in my heart, and I in yours. So it must be—"
She stopped to take breath.
"What have I come for?" she began again with nervous haste. "To embrace your feet, to press your hands like this till it hurts. You remember how in Moscow I used to squeeze them. To tell you again that you are my God, my joy. To tell you that I love you madly."
She moaned in anguish and suddenly pressed his hand greedily to her lips. Tears streamed from her eyes. Alyosha stood speechless and confounded. He'd never expected what he was seeing.
"Love is over, Mitya," Katya began again. "But the past is painfully dear to me. No, that will always be so. But now, let what might have been come true. For 1 minute," she faltered with a drawn smile, looking into his face joyfully again. "You love another woman and I love another man. And yet I shall love you forever, and you will love me. Do you know that? Do you hear? Love me. Love me all your life."
she cried with a quiver, almost a menace in her voice.
I shall love you and... Do you know, Katya?
Mitya began, drawing a deep breath at each word.
Do you know, 5 days ago that same evening, I loved you when you fell down and were carried out. All my life. So it will be, so it will always be.
So they murmured to one another frantic words, almost meaningless, perhaps not even true. But at that moment it was all true, and they both believed what they said implicitly.
Katya,
cried Mitya suddenly,
do you believe I murdered him? I know you don't believe it now, but then, when you gave evidence, surely, surely you did not believe it.
I did not believe it even then. I've never believed it. I hated you, and for a moment I persuaded myself. While I was giving evidence, I persuaded myself and believed it. But when I'd finished speaking, I left off believing it at once. Don't doubt that. I have forgotten that I came here to punish myself.
She said, with a new expression in her voice, quite unlike the loving tones of a moment before.
Woman, yours is a heavy burden,
broke, as it were, involuntarily from Mitya.
Let me go, she whispered. I'll come again. It's more than I can bear now.
She was getting up from her place, but suddenly uttered a loud scream and staggered back. Grushenka walked suddenly and noiselessly into the room. No one had expected her. Katya moved swiftly to the door, but when she reached Grushenka, she stopped suddenly, turned as white as chalk, and moaned softly, almost in a whisper.
Forgive me.
Grushenka stared at her, and pausing for an instant, in a vindictive, venomous voice, answered,
We're full of hatred, my girl, you and I. We're both full of hatred, as though we could forgive one another. Save him, and I'll worship you all my life. You won't forgive her,
cried Mitya with frantic reproach.
Don't be anxious. I'll save him for you.
Katya whispered rapidly, and she ran out of the room.
And you could refuse to forgive her when she begged your forgiveness herself?
Mitya exclaimed bitterly again.
Mitya, don't dare to blame her. You have no right to.
Alyosha cried hotly.
Her proud lips spoke, not her heart.
Grushenka brought out in a tone of disgust.
If she saves you, I'll forgive her everything.
She stopped speaking as though suppressing something. She could not yet recover herself. She'd come in, as appeared afterwards, accidentally, with no suspicion of what she would meet.
Alyosha, run after her,
Mitya cried to his brother.
Tell her, I don't know, don't let her go away like this.
I'll come to you again at nightfall,
said Alyosha, and he ran after Katya. He overtook her outside the hospital grounds. She was walking fast, but as soon as Alyosha caught her up, she said quickly,
No, before that woman I can't punish myself. I asked her forgiveness because I wanted to punish myself to the bitter end. She would not forgive me. I like her for that,
she added in an unnatural voice, and her eyes flashed with fierce resentment.
My brother did not expect this in the least, muttered Alyosha. He was sure she would not come.
No doubt. Let us leave that, she snapped. Listen, I can't go with you to the funeral now. I've sent them flowers. I think they still have money. If necessary, tell them I'll never abandon them. Now, leave me. Leave me, please. You're late as it is, the bells are ringing for the service. Leave me, please.
Chapter 3. The last chapter, Ilusha's funeral. The speech at the stone. He really was late. They had waited for him and had already decided to bear the pretty, flower-decked little coffin to the church without him. It was the coffin of poor little Ilusha. He had died 2 days after Mitya was sentenced. At the gate of the house, Alyosha was met by the shouts of the boys, Ilusha's schoolfellows. They'd all been impatiently expecting him and were glad that he'd come at last. There were about 12 of them. They all had their school bags or satchels on their shoulders.
Father will cry. Be with father,
Ilusha had told them as he lay dying, and the boys remembered it. Kolya Krasotkin was the foremost of them.
How glad I am you've come, Karamazov, he cried, holding out his hand to Alyosha. It's awful here. It's really horrible to see it. Snegiryov is not drunk. We know for a fact he's had nothing to drink today, but he seems as if he were drunk. I'm always manly, but this is awful. Karamazov, if I'm not keeping you, one question before you go in.
What is it, Kolya?
Said Alyosha. Is your brother innocent or guilty? Was it he killed your father, or was it the valet? As you say, so will it be. I haven't slept for the last 4 nights for thinking of it.
The valet killed him. My brother is innocent, answered Alyosha.
That's what I said, cried Smurov. So he'll perish an innocent victim, exclaimed Kolya. Though he is ruined, he is happy. I could envy him.
What do you mean? How can you? Why?
Cried Alyosha, surprised. Oh, if I too could sacrifice myself some day for truth, said Kolya with enthusiasm.
But not in such a cause, not with such disgrace and such horror, said Alyosha.
Of course, I should like to die for all humanity, and as for disgrace, I don't care about that. Our names may perish. I respect your brother. And so do I.
The boy who had once declared that he knew who had founded Troy cried suddenly and unexpectedly, and he blushed up to his ears like a peony, as he had done on that occasion.
Alyosha went into the room. Ilusha lay with his hands folded and his eyes closed in a blue coffin with a white frill round it. His thin face was hardly changed at all, and strange to say there was no smell of decay from the corpse. The expression of his face was serious and, as it were, thoughtful. His hands, crossed over his breast, looked particularly beautiful, as though chiselled in marble. There were flowers in his hands, and the coffin, inside and out, was decked with flowers, which had been sent early in the morning by Lisa Holakov. But there were flowers, too, from Katerina Ivanovna, and when Alyosha opened the door, the captain had a bunch in his trembling hands, and was strewing them again over his dear boy. He scarcely glanced at Alyosha when he came in, and he would not look at anyone, even at his crazy, weeping wife, Mama, who kept trying to stand on her crippled legs to get a nearer look at her dead boy. Nina had been pushed in her chair by the boys close up to the coffin. She sat with her head pressed to it, and she too was no doubt quietly weeping. Snegiryov's face looked eager, yet bewildered and exasperated. There was something crazy about his gestures and the words that broke from him.
"Old man, dear old man,"
he exclaimed every minute, gazing at Ilusha. It was his habit to call Ilusha old man as a term of affection when he was alive. "Father, give me a flower too. Take that white one out of his hand and give it me," the crazy mother begged, whimpering. Either because the little white rose in Ilusha's hand had caught her fancy, or that she wanted one from his hand to keep in memory of him, she moved restlessly, stretching out her hands for the flower.
"I won't give it to anyone. I won't give you anything,"
Snegiryov cried callously.
"They're his flowers, not yours. Everything is his. Nothing is yours."
"Father, give Mother a flower," said Nina, lifting her face wet with tears.
"I won't give away anything, and to her less than anyone. She didn't love Ilusha. She took away his little cannon, and he gave it to her."
The captain broke into loud sobs at the thought of how Ilusha had given up his cannon to his mother. The poor crazy creature was bathed in noiseless tears, hiding her face in her hands. The boys, seeing that the father would not leave the coffin and that it was time to carry it out, stood round it in a close circle and began to lift it up.
"I don't want him to be buried in the churchyard,"
Snegiryov wailed suddenly.
"I'll bury him by the stone, by our stone. Ilusha told me to. I won't let him be carried out."
He'd been saying for the last 3 days that he would bury him by the stone. But Alyosha, Krasotkin, the landlady, her sister, and all the boys interfered.
"What an idea, bury him by an unholy stone, as though he'd hanged himself,"
the old landlady said sternly.
"There in the churchyard the ground has been crossed. He'll be prayed for there. One can hear the singing in church, and the deacon reads so plainly and verbally that it will reach him every time, just as though it read over his grave."
At last the captain made a gesture of despair, as though to say, "Take him where you will." The boys raised the coffin, but as they passed the mother they stopped for a moment and lowered it, that she might say goodbye to Ilusha.
but on seeing that precious little face which for the last 3 days she'd only looked at from a distance, she trembled all over and her grey head began twitching spasmodically over the coffin. "Mother, make the sign of the cross over him. Give him your blessing, kiss him," Nina cried to her, but her head still twitched like